This is the Aftermarket Radio Network.
Welcome to another episode of Speak Up Effective Communication, the show on the Automotive Repair Podcast Network focused on our communication and leadership skills. In our episode today, I'm going to tell you about a phone call that happened the night before 7 people died. My research for this episode has really taken, 25 years of experience, some avid historical reading all throughout, 3 weeks of recent reading, 1 5-kilometer ruck, and at least 3 hours of AI-fueled research and outlining to help me organize my thoughts. And this topic that I am bringing you today is one I consider vitally important and urgently relevant for our industry, really for our society in general. And the topic is pessimism aversion. Aversion is also the word of our day today, which I will define for you after we hear a word from our sponsors who make this show possible. Stop stressing over your business. You deserve a good night's sleep. The Institute's coaching helps you achieve success and financial peace. Learn more at weareintheinstitute.com/business-assessment. Autoflow is your partner in technology. With Autoflow, enhance your client interactions in a single thread before, during, and after the visit. To see how Autoflow makes it simple, visit autoflow.com. Your trusted companion, Shop Dog Marketing, is right by your side, attracting the best customers and building long-term growth. Call Shop Dog Marketing today or visit shopdogmarketing.com. Supercharge your auto shop with Inbound. AI-powered communication analytics and phone service for your professional shops. Visit callinbound.com. Are you passing along credit card fees to your customers? No one likes that. Express is the only 0% fee alternative to credit card surcharging. Visit myexpress.io. Okay, folks, we're back, and aversion is our word of the day, and it is a noun, which means a strong dislike or disinclination. So pair that up with pessimism aversion, and I think you get a sense for the theme of today. We do not like focusing on negative things at all. I get it. Optimism is much more cheerful. We enjoy optimistic, happy, upbeat, forward-thinking people that are going to get things done. And if you have someone pessimistic on your team that is slowing things down, you know how frustrating that can be. Some of us feel like an anchor sometimes when we have to bring up some potential bad outcomes and maybe say, no, stop. Let's think about this for a minute. Pessimism can take on a lot of different forms. Pessimism aversion is not something that anyone should aspire to entirely, especially as business leaders and just general citizens in our society. Now, I mentioned a phone call that took place, and this is a story that we're going to go back to. Some of you will remember. Some of you were too young like I was to really remember. But this phone call that happened the night before 7 people died took place on January 27, 1986. And that involved engineers on an emergency teleconference. The stakes were in regards to the Space Shuttle Challenger launch that was scheduled for the next morning. History, of course, recalls very clearly the tragedy that unfolded with that particular event. Before I tell you what happened on that call, you need to understand what the engineers on that call were actually worried about. There's a serious technical problem here, and I swear, I'm turning more and more into my grandfather every time I have a conversation about anything on the planet, whether it be health or technical malfunctions or you name it. But while this particular problem with the Challenger dealing with cold weather and hard rubber O-rings and seals sure reminds me of my days in the transmission business. And there it is. All right, now we're going to make a transmission shop reference on all this stuff. But the reality is the Space Shuttle Challenger launch was problematic chiefly because of the weather that Florida was experiencing that time. A lot of times this goes understated. You hear about an O-ring issue, but it is cold weather. That was one of the reasons that these engineers needed to have this conference call. And I'll tell you from a transmission shop perspective, of course, which was my background, we've loved that mid-90s, especially those early Dodge transmissions were notorious for hard seal issues. The cold weather sets in where I'm at in Michigan, and you can absolutely plan on getting that phone call with people that saying, hey, when they started up their vehicle, it really felt like it was slipping really bad, and then kind of got better as things warmed up. And as temperatures increase, so does the flexibility of some of the rubber seals, especially in the technology in that day. So when I see this story, the Challenger, it's hard not to draw those parallels. And mind you, the Florida temperature, it was supposed to be at like 36 degrees Fahrenheit during the launch time for the Challenger. And that's very unusual in Florida. I have colleagues down in Florida, friends and family down there too. It gets cold. Well, really, it gets cold, I feel like, every time I go down there. But it doesn't usually get that cold. Even in January, that kind of a cold snap does not take very long. The rubber O-rings that seal the rocket booster joints were the things that the engineers were concerned about. And basically, when a cold seal is super hard, it can't seal fast enough when the fuel ignites, and hot gas can leak through, creating a catastrophic failure. So, hey, if you're like me, transmission specialist from Michigan, this isn't exactly rocket science by itself, but this absolutely does involve the rocket science. Now, we're dealing with NASA engineers, though, so rocket science, yes, they had the data, they understood the problem, and the night before the launch, basically, these engineers had to make a call on go, no go. And this is dealing with the Morton Thiokol engineers. They were led by Roger Bojoli. I believe I pronounced that right. They presented data to their managers that the O-rings have never been tested below 53 degrees Fahrenheit. And previous launches at 53 Fahrenheit showed the worst O-ring erosion they'd ever seen. They barely avoided disaster at that temperature. Knowing O-ring erosion by any standard, that's just another way of saying like the seal was physically damaged. It was at that temperature. So with the launch day estimate, the O-rings would be at 29 degrees Fahrenheit, nearly 25 degrees below the known dangerous threshold. And they made a very clear-cut recommendation. They said, do not launch. So that's the whole point of that phone call. It was a teleconference. Normally, Zoom meetings and everything else, being from Michigan too, first thing people do is talk about weather. I don't think that's how engineers work. They simply had this conference because of the weather. They immediately started talking about the particular issue. This is kind of where the interesting thing took place. You had a room full of engineers. I believe there was 13 engineers in the room at the time, and this did not go the way that you would expect a conversation with such high caliber professionals to go. This was the background of the call. The first part of the teleconference call was starting at, I believe it was 8:45 p.m. to 10:30 p.m. This was the first part of the call. And I'm going to quote here a portion of this from an article that was quoting also from a book. It was Klaus Jensen's book called Contest for the Heavens, The Road to the Challenger Disaster. I believe this was written in 1996, so all references are to that book unless I indicate otherwise. But Jolie's argument was simple. The colder the O-ring, the more hard and less responsive it is, and the more viscous is the grease around it, so it takes longer to seat, allowing gases to burn past it and erode it. He told the Rogers Commission about this temperature effect. It was easier to squeeze a sponge into a crack than it was to force a brick. And then they went on to show this. This is then the point where the framing started to shift. Bojoli is asked to quantify his concern. Could he give a probability of failure? And of course he can't. Of the 25 launches, this is the coldest launch by far. All he can do is say that, and this is an interesting quote, it was away from goodness in the current database. So, okay. This teleconference does proceed, and at this point, one of the more interesting characters does get involved, and that was Robert Lund. He's the VP of engineering at Thiokol, and it's basically his job to help the engineers engage with management. Now, hey, I'm in a software company. We have software developers, and a lot of times we have to engage in client success. So the people that are the people are dealing with engineers, and sometimes these can be challenging conversations. You're dealing with pragmatic, hard facts from the engineer types, and you're trying to translate it to people who want different outcomes than what the engineers maybe want to or can safely say they can deliver. So I'm a little familiar with this. Basically, Lund agreed, said that Challenger should not be launched in those temperatures. But we saw the conversation shift to a different kind of a meeting. It actually broke up. So the managers decided to get together, and with the VP of engineering, Lund, they actually showed him the quote that is really famous for this, is that they told him that he needs to put on his manager hat instead of his engineer hat. That was actually said by Gerald Jerry Mason. He was the senior vice president of Wasatch operations at Morton Thiokol. He was the most senior Thiokol manager that was present on this call. So he said this to Robert Lund, vice president of engineering: take off your engineering hat and put on your management hat. Now, this is where it gets really even more complicated, because this is now turning into a management decision, not a engineering decision. And those managers saying, actually, quoting again, "Am I the only one who wants to fly?" 10 engineers in the room stood firmly against this launch, but Mason quickly got agreement from two other vice presidents, Wiggins and Kilminster. And then he turned to Lund, who was that VP of engineering, had just presented the recommendation not to launch, and told him to change his hat. So what happened next? Lund changed his vote. The recommendation was reversed to approve launch. And when Rogers Commission later asked Lund, how did you explain that fact that you change your mind when you change your quote unquote hat? He had a hard time explaining this. But the devastating detail is this: even after management wrote up the new recommendation to launch, the engineers refused to sign it, showing how certain they were that it was not safe. There was even another point inside of this meeting that it was later in one of the hearings that it's quoted here, says Arnie, the other Thiokol engineer, vehemently against the launch, actually got up from his position, which was down the table, and walked up the table and put a quarter pad down in front of the table in front of the management folks, and tried to sketch out once again what his concern was with the joint. And when he realized he wasn't getting through, he just stopped. Said, "I tried one more time with photos. I also stopped when it was apparent I couldn't get anybody to listen." So the pushback, pessimism is the enemy, right? The NASA managers push back hard. They basically, if you really go and you analyze this stuff, and I do recommend reading that book if you're interested in this sort of thing. To summarize it, what happened is, instead of proving that it's safe to launch, the engineers were asked to prove that it wasn't safe, which they couldn't do because no other situation like this had actually happened. It was an unprecedented scenario for the space shuttle with that particular temperature in this scenario. Management overruled the engineers. They reversed the recommendation and they approved the launch. And hey, the critical breakdown is this: the engineers' warnings never did reach the NASA decision makers. Bad news was filtered out as it moved up the chain. Why? Because pessimism was seen as the problem, not the information that was being delivered. Pessimism that we shouldn't launch. And the launch proceeded. Despite freezing temperatures in Florida and ice on the pad, ice on the launch pad in Florida, January 28, 1986, 11:38 a.m., 73 seconds after the launch, Challenger exploded, all 7 crew members killed. The cause was exactly what the engineers predicted. At 29 degrees in Florida, the O-ring was too stiff. Hot gas leaked, external tank ruptured. The pessimists were right. In my opinion, what makes it even worse, they could have waited. They absolutely could have waited. We wouldn't have this case study anymore if that were the case. The following day, I believe, was even colder and broke another record temperature at that time. But a few more days away, and these cold snaps typically only last up to 4 or 6 days tops inside of Florida. These dangerous conditions were temporary. They were predictable. They would pass. The engineers, I don't know if they would have ever been vindicated if they had delayed the launch. When things go well, no one thinks of the pessimists that helped make it safer so that things would go well. The top shops in the industry don't stop at one location. At the Institute, we work with shop owners who want to expand, whether it's opening a second shop, acquiring new businesses, or building systems for long-term growth. Some of our clients are aiming for hundreds of shops, and we're helping them get there. Ready to scale? To get started, visit weareintheinstitute.com/business-assessment. Hey friends, as you know, I'm a proud member of the AutoFlow team, and let me tell you, we've changed how business is done for auto shops everywhere. We support your client experience before, during, and after the work is done. Imagine this: timely updates sent directly to your clients, branded digital vehicle inspections, and seamless communication from start to finish. That's why shops love AutoFlow. And hey, with those 5-star reviews rolling in, you'll wonder how you ever managed without us. Take an important next step and take your auto shop to the next level. Visit www.autoflow.com. Get on board with an AutoFlow trial. Want to see your auto repair shop thrive? Are you looking to drive more customers to your auto repair shop? Let ShopDog Marketing be your guide. Our customer-first approach, combined with AI-driven creative content, ensures top rankings. Dominate mobile-first and voice search with our specialized expertise. Reach out to ShopDog Marketing today and start growing your business. Don't miss out on this chance to boost your business. Visit shopdogmarketing.com. Inbound has exclusively served independent auto repair shops with expert communication solutions for years. Our robust VOIP platform ensures you stay connected while our industry-leading AI analytics take your business to the next level. We provide the tools you need to understand your customers and optimize every interaction. Choose Inbound for proven expertise and unmatched innovation. Visit callinbound.com and discover the difference we can make. Credit card surcharging sounds effective, but is the single most damaging action to your shop in the last decade? If you're surcharging, you're tarnishing your reputation and losing customers as we speak. Express is the only 0% fee option to surcharging that your customers already know how to use. No tricks, no hidden fees. Just a smarter way for auto shops to keep what's yours and do right by your customers. Book a free consultation with Express today by visiting myexpress.io and see how the most successful shops in the country are flipping the script on credit card processors. So, all right, why am I telling you this story today? Why do I think this is so important? This really isn't so much about the challenge. I just think that's a really good case study for exactly this sort of thing, how it can be where positive thinking itself can be destructive. The fact that a case like this exists is hopefully helpful for it. What I want to convey today, and what the real point of this pessimism aversion topic in my episode is about, is that I just think we have a relationship problem with pessimism. We treat negative news or pessimistic forecasts, if you will, like attacks on our optimism and our general expectation should be that everything turns out okay. There's this don't be negative, we'll figure it out, doom gloom talk. We don't need that. But in this case study, hey, those are engineers. They weren't being negative. They were actually just reading temperatures on a gauge. Ignoring that wasn't an option for them. That would just be abject denial. And right now in history, I do believe we have a tendency to do this again. And I hear this a lot, which brings me to my more current reading. I have picked up a challenge from my CEO to engage and leverage AI tools. We'll be talking continually about that sort of thing as it does affect our communication and leadership skills. But simultaneously to one book he recommended, I picked up another one. It's called The Coming Wave. I'm holding that up for those of you watching, by Mustafa Suleiman. And Mustafa Suleiman, by the way, is co-founder and CEO of Inflection AI. Previously, he co-founded DeepMind, one of the world's leading AI companies. AI technology insider, but he's talking about some serious dilemmas as we move into the 21st century. And it is very pessimistic. He deals heavily with the term pessimism aversion in his book. It is where I received this phrase and wanted to bring it to you. Basically, this is another situation where very smart people are raising warnings about serious economic disruption. And I see this. As I was recently at a conference here, I was having some conversations on this topic here, and I saw a typical tendency that I thought was very interesting. When we start talking about the automotive industry, we feel a little insulated from the AI stuff, maybe service advisors less so as it's starting to take on phone calls and other things. Maybe it'll help us write estimates and whatnot. I think staffing will be a little easier at the front counter as this technology continues to evolve because it will augment our service advisors, our skilled staff, our owners, to do a lot of things for us. But cognitive functions and skills are, or what I would call cognitive manual labor, is not something that I think will only be augmented over a period of time. I think eventually it is all going to go and be replaced. The thing I see with auto repair shops is most of the owners, like, and technicians too, is like, Well, we have all these dexterous joints, our fingers, our digits, our wrists, our elbows, and all the ways that we can move. We can manipulate tools a lot easier. No robots can be taking a technician job anytime soon. We're good. And I do believe that that's going to be true for quite some time here. Foreseeable future, though, for me, about now 1 to 3 years. So 1 to 3 years, we're good. And that's all I'll probably ever be able to say, or any of us might be able to say, with the speed that technology is coming again. And that is Mustafa Suleiman's point. And here's the other side of the point. Okay, maybe it's not going to come for blue-collar jobs for technicians working. I'm not trying to paint a negative picture exclusively here, but let's think about this a little further. Let's say cognitive manual labor is something that AI starts to do, and jobs do become displaced more quickly in the future than we expect. True or false? A good portion of our clientele that need their car fixed, that go to their office each day, are doing that sort of cognitive manual labor. And if their economic situation is no longer needed and their jobs go away and they drive less, what happens if AI even displaces 20 to 30% of those white collar jobs? What happens to repair frequency if money gets tight? What happens to new car sales and your business model in economic disruption? What if the optimistic timelines that we are trying to give ourselves are totally wrong? Now, I'm not trying to just go doom and gloom here. I think I've set the stage for that pretty well here. What we actually need to do is reframe the nature of this conversation, not the way that the case with Thiokol went with their engineers and their managers, where we're taking off an engineer hat, putting on a different hat, and ha ha ha, everything's good again. I'm saying, these are not attacks on your business. This isn't negativity. This is your temperature gauge. We're looking at a forecast right now, and I think it's really important that we just look at it objectively without burying our heads or distracting ourselves or just escaping into other things without thinking about it. I think there are some real significant warning signs with what this technology will do, and I think we're smart to start planning our businesses around it earlier, not later, in the aftermath of some of these changes. And these changes will accelerate, unlike any other technological revolution that we've had today. So here's what I want you to understand. We're going to make a new relationship here with pessimism. Pessimistic scenarios are not negativity. It's just data. Planning for the downside is not giving up. It's just business intelligence. You're going to be able to look at and assess the risks in your demographic. Shoot, some of you, again, we talk about this a lot, like federal workers right now as I'm recording this. This is still day one of shutdown. I don't know if it's hourly news. Maybe it's better already, even as I sit here. But people with federal workers as their employees, this is serious, right? That's a big part of your client base. You know, if the government shut down, they don't drive. We talked about this on an episode with Hunt Demarest. Just call your customers. Look, the shops that will survive this next decade, even, it's not going to be the most optimistic people. Yes, some demographics will be easier than others, but it's just going to be people who are able to assess and change and be flexible and dynamic and aware of their surroundings. The other book I wanted to bring in, other than Mustafa Suleiman's, bring you a quote from that one here in a moment, it's actually Testament of Hope, very optimistic title, from Martin Luther King Jr., his sermon, Remaining Awake Through a Great Revolution. A perfect title, by the way, for the technological revolution we're in. I think I'll continue to use that title regularly. But he says, and I'll quote on page 269 of this book, "One of the great liabilities of life is that all too many people find themselves living amid a great period of social change, and yet they fail to develop new attitudes, the new mental responses that the new situation demands. They end up sleeping through a revolution." And he goes on, he says, "There could be no gainsaying of the fact that a great revolution is taking place in the world today. In a sense, it is a triple revolution. That is a technological revolution with the impact of automation and cybernation. There's a revolution in weaponry with the emergence of atomic nuclear weapons of warfare. Then there is a human rights revolution with the freedom explosion that is taking place all over the world. Yes, we do live in a period where changes are taking place, and there is still the voice crying through the vista of time saying, behold, I make all things new. Former things are passed away." Oh, I love his writing. So, all right, let's go back into Mustafa Suleiman for just a second. There's an interesting passage that I want to say was 178. Got it. He's give you some context of this page here too. Silliman is saying that with the arrival of the latest generation of large language models, I'm now more convinced than ever that this is how things will play out, that these tools will only temporarily augment human intelligence. They will make us smarter and more efficient for a time and will unlock enormous amounts of economic growth, but they are fundamentally labor replacing. They will eventually do cognitive labor more efficiently and more cheaply than many people working in administration, data entry, customer service, including making and receiving phone calls, writing emails, drafting summaries, translating documents, creating content, copywriting, and so on. In the face of an abundance of ultra-low cost equivalents, the days of this kind of cognitive manual labor are numbered. It's page 178 of The Coming Wave. Super fun read, right? No, I know, it can get really depressing. No, trust me, I've had to pick this one up and put it down several times. It is not a fun thought to think about, especially raising teenagers and kids going through there. And I just did a recent episode with our new friend, Quinn Butler, who is recently graduating college. There's lots of upside to all this stuff. And we'll certainly revisit a lot of the upside as we continue to go through here. I'm a little bit more concerned, though, about what we do to pessimists, people who are talking about the potential negative downsides. Do we cast them away? What happens? And I think the human cost of what happens to the truth tellers of our day is really serious as things get like the Challenger explosion happened. Take, for example, Roger Bojoli. He testified honestly about what happened, but it was immediately ostracized at Morton Thiokol. His colleagues stopped speaking to him. He took medical leave for depression, eventually left the company, spent the rest of his life speaking about engineering ethics. His guilt, he said, I knew, and they died anyway. Terrible thing to live with. And other engineers also reported trauma. They were right, but powerless. The hidden cost is we don't just ignore pessimists, we destroy them. Then they wonder why nobody speaks up again next time. That's a serious problem, in my opinion. So, without going too much deeper into the AI topic in general or some of the other literature I have here, we could do this for hours. I just want to tie this up with what I think is important. I think we'll go back to the Challenger thing. The engineers did everything right and they paid for it. Seven people died because pessimism wasn't welcome. Now, tie it to your business, your livelihood depends on being willing to hear what you don't want to hear. When someone shows you data that challenges your optimism, listen to it. It's data. You can listen to it. And when forecasts do look grim, don't shoot the messenger. Use the information. That's the other key thing. Sorry to say is not what I see happening in this time. I think that there's some attitudes that really want to just focus on the positive. Good outcomes will come that we couldn't have even anticipated. And you're probably right. But somebody probably anticipated some negative outcomes to help create those good outcomes. So use the data that's given to you. Your temperature gauge doesn't care about your feelings. It's just giving you data. So the final thought here, I just wanted to reiterate this again. Our industry is not insulated from this coming wave. I think that, yes, blue-collar worker jobs are going to be great. A blue-collar worker, I consider this a profession anyway. This is a high-tech job. I was having a great time talking, and I hope to talk again with Matt Fonslow soon. I think there's going to be some technology that comes out that's going to help those A technicians not be as in demand. I considered myself a B-plus technician, folks. When I was wrenching, I was pretty good, but I wasn't much of a diag tech. My brother was that guy, and so he was our resource. I always went to him, and he told me, as I talked about with Matt and Sean on a recent episode, he could tell me where to go hook things up, and I could do it, and I could get the scope and everything ready, but I needed him to interpret the data. Question. With AI known goods and AI diagnostic procedures being more documented better than ever, could it tell a B-plus technician where to hook up the equipment to diagnose the problem and then help them interpret the data? I think that AI's cut and dry for this. What does that mean for the payroll for those really skilled diag techs? Well, when they're not as in demand because there's AI tools and a solid B-plus tech who makes less money can do the job. And let's face it, less white-collar jobs mean more people interested in working with their hands again because it's employment opportunity. Man, I think we could solve our technician crisis. What happens when we solve our technician crisis? Do wages go up or down? Wages go down. And then all of a sudden it's more competitive for technicians again, and you can't just pick and choose which shop you want to go to anymore. Now there's a whole nother variable shift, and there's lots of things that we could go down. But if you let yourself start accepting the fact that, hey, some of the outcomes you maybe don't want to entertain are possible, you can start to think about how flexible you need to become in order to keep doing what you do or do something a little different and more effective. It can be distressing if we dwell in this negativity, but this is not the point. We are not powerless. We are not like those engineers who are being overridden by the managers in that room. The ones launching all this new technology are going to continue to launch all of this new technology. We know that. We just need to remain awake through this revolution. All right, here's another crucial point. I think there are powerful reasons that pessimism gets discouraged. It's both evolutionary and institutional. Some of the evolutionary and psychological things, look, optimists get more done. Pessimists who always see danger don't build, innovate, or take necessary risks. There's also more social rewards for optimistic people. They're more fun. They get promoted. They attract resources and allies. It's how they work. There's also this thing, survivorship bias. We celebrate the optimists who are right, Edison, Jobs, and we forget pessimists who saved us from disasters we never experienced. The pessimist who prevents a disaster gets no credit because nothing happened. It's just that survivorship bias thing. Like you've heard this said before too. It's like when you think of like CIA stuff, no one ever even thinks about the CIA until they mess up. I'm sure there's plenty of things we would have to be thankful for crises they helped us avert. Then there's the institutional career level thing. Being the pessimist, it can be career suicide. You're the one slowing everything down, costing money. You're not a team player. And it's asymmetric in terms of consequences. If you're pessimistic, if you are pessimistic and wrong, you killed the project. If you're optimistic and wrong, oh, nobody could have prevented this. And then there's the loss aversion for decision makers. Saying no means accepting a certain loss, delay, cost, criticism, whatever, versus a probabilistic future harm. Saying no to something means you accepted that reality. And that's, yeah, it's frustrating. I get it. The person who stops progress is also visible. The person who enables disaster, however, hides in collective failure. So standing up and standing out, speaking up when you have something negative to say is a little bit more challenging. Mustafa Suleiman hits on this in his book as well. There's the market competitive pressure. If you don't build it, someone else will. And this is where the book, The Coming Wave, is really interesting, because you have nation states competing with nation states to rush face first into all of the possible AI things. The guardrails are off. It's like we are running full speed ahead with this technology, because if you fall behind, I mean, militaristically, it has obvious implications. We can't let that happen. And every single technology company worth their salt is going to be saying the same thing. No one wants to be the last one to the party on this topic. And there's some first mover advantages. If you are first and you don't fall behind, you stay ahead. That's good. No one wants to fall behind their competitors. And then when it comes to funding, funding flows to optimism. Investors, grants, public support, all that goes to those who are promising breakthroughs, not those who are cautiously plodding along. But nation-state competition, I think, makes this a unilateral restraint feel like a unilateral disarmament. You can't decide to not go ahead with this. There is another darker side to all this. The system actually does reward optimism bias in general, the system being a very broad term in whatever element we are. But even when catastrophe happens, because individual career incentives favor the yes people, right? Collective responsibility diffuses the blame when things fail. And we only learn after disasters and then slowly forget. So, and I feel like maybe that's kind of where we're heading into today. And I see evidence of it all over the place. And I will not go political on this show, but it's an interesting thing out there. It is. One last thing. The psychological toll, multiple engineers actually reported severe guilt and trauma from this. That quote I read from Vajoli earlier is, "I knew and they died anyway." Some described it as PTSD, replaying the teleconference they were wondering if they could have argued harder. And Beaujolais said he actually felt he failed the crew despite doing something technically right. So, hey, I hope this is a helpful topic, and I hope it stirs some thoughts and interest in you. If there is something you want to add to this conversation, I do encourage you, please reach out to me here at speakup@craigoneill.net. That is speakup@craigoneill.net. I would love to hear from you, and if you want to add to this in a conversation with me, I'd be happy to do a podcast with you as well. I also want to remind you, go listen to the other shows on the Aftermarket Radio Network. Folks, I saw a t-shirt on one of the attendees at ASTA recently. It said harm's way on the shirt, like get out of the way. That's harm's way. Get out of harm's way. That was kind of funny. It made me laugh, but I was hanging out with Carm Capriotto a lot. And I was just thinking, it's like, harm's way. I don't know. There's some joke here. I can't find it yet, but I'm going to find it. Maybe there's even a t-shirt that needs to be made for harm's way. But Carm's Way is on Remarkable Results Radio. I hope you will listen to that. And also, our friend Matt Fonslow on Diagnosing the Aftermarket A through Z, Hunt Demarest, Business by the Numbers, Kim and Brian Walker on the Auto Shop Repair Marketing Podcast, and Coach Chris Cotton on the Weekly Blitz. So, folks, I do want to remind you, yes, we talked about pessimism a lot today, and I threw some quotes at you from some things, some of it optimistic, some of it not. Stay awake. Keep listening up, speak up, and stay awake. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Speak Up, Effective Communication with Craig O'Neill on the Aftermarket Radio Network. Follow Craig on your favorite podcast listening app and on his YouTube channel. Let him know what you'd like him to speak up about. Craig is all for advancing the automotive service aftermarket.